It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The U.S. may be in a retirement wave. The country has around 2.7 million more retirees than predicted by a model from the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. What's behind the apparent jump in retirement? For some people who have retirement accounts that include the stock market, a jump in the markets could make retirement more affordable. But there's more to the story, including some workplace negatives that might be driving people into retirement before they feel ready. And with record numbers of Americans reaching the age of 65 at the same time this year, retirement decisions are a pretty big deal. An expert on retirement and finance will help us break down the causes and effects of retirement trends and what you should know before retiring. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you retired recently or are you about to? Have you moved the timeline up or back? Or are you completely confused about what retirement living will cost you? You don't know when to retire. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Carrie Hannon is a senior columnist for Yahoo Finance. She's written a number of books on work and retirement, including In Control at 50 Plus, How to Succeed in the New World of Work. Carrie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, it's so great to be here again. And what a great topic.
Super interesting. And this number I mentioned, you know, over 2.5 million more retirees than we expected. Okay, that's just one data point. You've got your finger on the pulse of retirement, Carrie. Are you seeing this? Are people pulling the trigger and retiring more so this year than they had been?
You know, I think what's interesting, Rob, is there are several little pieces to this puzzle, but the first one you nailed. Yes, in fact, we're seeing a lot of retirements this year. And you mentioned also, this is, they're calling it peak 65. More people are turning 65 this year than ever in history. So this is a big deal. And why retirement becomes top of mind at 65 is there are two big things here. The first one is that's when you become eligible for Medicare. And a lot of people hang on to their jobs for the health insurance. So when they have the ability to, hey, okay, I've got Medicare now, and whoa, look at my 401k balance. We had a super year last year. The stock market was, let's say, robust. And so the fact that there are a lot of people looking at those account balances and saying, well, just maybe I can make this jump. And in fact, they are. But I do think there's a second trend that we're seeing here is that, in fact, you know, more people over 65 are actually in the job market. You know, roughly one in five Americans over the age of 65 were employed last year in 2023. And that's four times the number in the mid-1980s. I mean, more Americans are working to longer ages if they can. And this is generally, and let's call it knowledge jobs. These aren't necessarily physical labor jobs where, in fact, it's much harder to stay on the job longer. But we're seeing this stretch out. So, and I'm also seeing, oh gosh, you'll love this one, Rob. People do retire, like we're seeing the retirements right now, but then they unretire. So that's a whole other surge of people that have stopped. And this, we're still early in this year, but they step out for a while. And this happened during the pandemic. They may have even been laid off. But they've come back to work. So those are some of the big things I'm seeing. But let's dig into some of this.
Exactly what I wanted to say next. I want to dig into a few of the different things you just said. First of all, now, the 401k thing, right? If people have retirement money invested in the stock market and the stock market's doing good, great, happy days. It's the reverse of 2008. They can maybe retire earlier. But many people, maybe most people, I don't know what the numbers are, don't have money in retirement accounts with the stock market. Some people don't have any retirement accounts. Can you talk about them a little bit and how dire this could look once they hit age 65, plus or minus?
Yeah, Rob, good point. And this is really startling. In this country, only 50%, roughly 50% of workers have access to an employer-provided retirement plan. And if you don't have access to a retirement plan, trust me, it's really hard to set that money aside paycheck to paycheck. And we find that a lot of people are seriously unprepared for retirement because they have simply not been able to build up enough of a balance. And frankly, given longevity, right, we're living lots of numbers are out there, but roughly, you know, people are living longer than previous generations have. And so if you step out of the workplace at 65, potentially you have 3 decades to finance in what we call retirement. And that's just not sustainable. Medicare does not cover all your healthcare costs. In fact, Fidelity has a number that says something like a couple who retired last year at 65 might spend as much as $350,000 out of pocket between now and when they are no longer here. So that is a huge amount of money. And so I'm a little scared about that whole thing. So there's a set of people that have choice, right? They can say, hey, I can step away now. And there's a set that's going to just keep on working as long as they possibly can in order to keep that income coming in. So this is a situation that we're going to see 2 different stories.
Talking to Carrie Hannon, expert on work and retirement, looking at a big jump of the number of retired people in the United States this year and a lot of pieces of the puzzle behind that. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, or if you have an example, your own or someone close to you, maybe in your family or at your workplace, the retirement story there, love to hear it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carrie, another explanation some people have pointed to for a jump in retirements this year. We mentioned the positive one. Hey, maybe your stock market-based retirement account is looking pretty good. But also some negative things like it could be return to office. Some people don't want to return to office when their employer demands it. Maybe this is something that boots them out the door faster, or other reasons to not like the current state of the workforce that they're in. What do you think? How big a factor do you think that is?
Yeah, Rob, it is a factor, because the one thing that workers at this age want out of a job is flexibility. And when there was this push to get people back into the office, they're saying, hey, you know what? I just don't want to do that. You know, I'm not putting up with the computer. I may have commute to the office. I may have a healthcare issue that prevents me to really, you know, I've really gotten into this remote work thing. This is working for me. And it actually helps with ageism as well. When you're working remotely, you're not judged by your cover as much. So there is that definitely at play. Although I will say, I recently was doing some reporting with CEOs, and they, you know, it was a study I came across from the conference board that said that even though we hear a lot of noise about companies saying you have to come back to the office, you have to, they're really talking 3 days a week, and only 7% of CEOs said that this was a priority for them this year. I think they want people back in, but they're realizing that at all ages, this idea of working and workplace flexibility has really taken root. But for an experienced older worker, I think we've done our time in the trenches. You know, I'm kind of in that, I'm not quite in that age group, but I'm close enough. And so I think we're seeing a bit of that. We're also, I think there is ageism out there. There is this sense that, you know, you're being pushed out a little bit. And there were a lot of layoffs during the pandemic because of this. But I got to insist, I mean, older workers, older Americans are staying in the workplace, you know, age 65 and older, they've represented something like a quarter of the increase in the labor force over the past 25 years. I don't see that changing, because here's what's happening. The sheer demographics, employers don't have as many young people coming up. It's an aging population. So they are finding there's no wonder that we still have a tight labor market, because they're having trouble finding workers with the skills and talents they need to enter the workplace, because there's just not as many young people in the pipeline. So it's not a generational tussle. What I'm saying is just sheer demographics. So employers are increasingly starting to eye these more experienced older workers and say, hey, maybe we do want you to stick around.
We're talking to Carrie Hannon, senior columnist for Yahoo Finance, author of a bunch of books about work and retirement, and sometimes work after retirement. We're talking about what looks like a retirement wave hitting the U.S. More, according to the Federal Reserve, more people retired than they would have predicted based on you know, your basic demographics, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you part of this story? Have you retired recently? Are you making that decision right now about how and when? Maybe you're confused about it. If so, you are, I promise, not alone. Have you retired, in quotes, but then started working again? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Carrie Hannon, senior columnist for Yahoo Finance, about a recent spike in the number of retirees in the U.S., how it can inform our own retirement plans. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Maybe your own stories about making that retirement decision. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Will is with us in Eau Claire. Will, hi.
Hi, Rob and Terry. Great show. My wife and I went through the process of deciding when to retire and all of that stuff, crunching the numbers a few years ago. A big consideration was Social Security, you know, in terms of how much money you're going to save, how much money you'll make over the long run. So getting some help was very worthwhile. And then the whole process, once we decided, was real simple. So Social Security, big question mark. Thanks. I'll just take my answer off the air or comment, really. Thank you.
Will, thanks a lot for the call. Carrie, how important is figuring out our Social Security in planning when to retire?
You know, Will, Will just hit it right there. This is so critical. People do not understand exactly how the Social Security benefit is going to come to them. And it's really quite confusing. I mean, they did push the full retirement age from 65 to 67. But of course, you can start getting your benefit at 62. But what happens is you get a reduced benefit starting at 62. If you get to your full retirement age, it's a bit higher. And if you can wait till age 70, between your full retirement age and age 70, you get roughly an 8% increase each year in the amount your check will be for the rest of your life. So it's, you know, you do have to talk to somebody and run some of these numbers and find out how it's going to work for you. Now, the beauty of it is once you've reached your full retirement age and you start taking Social Security, hey, you can work. It doesn't stop you from doing a part-time job or a contract job, and it doesn't impact your Social Security check at all. So what I'm seeing is a lot of people, you know, taking that path. They're saying, hey, you know, I'm gonna retire from my primary career. I'm going to start my Social Security payment now. And I'm going to start that monthly check, which is a great, you know, no guaranteed annuity. It's like an annuity. It's one of the best things going, really. But then I'm going to continue to work as a safety net, or just for cash flow, or to not have to dip into savings. There's so many great reasons to continue to work in some fashion if you want to, if you can. And also, you might step away briefly and go do all those things you've been putting off. But then you might find, hey, you know what? I really do want a reason to get up in the morning. I want to feel relevant. I want to feel engaged in the world, mentally, physically, networking, socially. And yeah, a paycheck is amazingly helpful.
Thanks for that call, Will, at 800-642-1234. Carrie, for someone in Will's position a few years ago, the question of can I afford to retire or when can I afford to retire? It's a big question. We won't get through the entire process, but how can people start to evaluate that when they can afford to retire question?
Yeah, it's really important to take a very clear look at your lifestyle and your budget and what you expect your expenses might be moving forward. You know, do you have outstanding debts? Can you get those paid down before you step away from the workplace? Can you move to a place where the cost of living is less, or a smaller home? These are questions that are big picture things, and you've got to work those through. And you have to think about healthcare, because this is a huge piece of what your expenses are going to be moving forward for many people. And that has impact on, you know, it can vary by where you live, even what those costs might be. So you need to sort of play it out a bit, figure out what resources, what income you could have coming in, the Social Security. You may have other assets that are going to pay off for you. And so it's really taking a clear-eyed look of how you expect your lifestyle to be. And I also encourage people, you know, to really go to the Social Security website. They have a great, you have a My Social Security account. They can show you exactly what your check is going to be at 62, at full retirement age, and at age 70. And that's very helpful to at least get a snapshot of what that might be. And what are your sources of income be? We know a recent study I saw from TIAA showed that one in four Americans have absolutely no idea how much they have in retirement accounts.
Now, you've mentioned working after retirement some. And one of the last times I talked to you, Carrie, we talked about surveys that show that a lot of people think they're going to work some after retirement. Fewer actually do. Why is that? I've forgotten enough since that last conversation. You can remind me.
Oh, my goodness. You have a pretty good memory, though. Yes, this is a big issue. I am a huge fan of work. I always say work is not a four-letter word. It is great. But you can't just step out of the workplace and then expect you're going to step back in and everyone's going to clamor to have you on their payroll. It takes a lot of things in order to be able to stay employed in some way. You have to keep your skills up to date. You need to keep your network sharp. And those sorts of things are important. But probably the biggest thing that happens to people, Rob, is that they have health issues that prevent them from actually getting back into the workplace, and or they're caring for an aging relative. And this makes it super hard. And in addition to that, they may also face what I alluded to earlier. Ageism is alive and well in the workplace. And sometimes you can try and try and try. You're never going to replicate that old job you had for sure. But it is still a tricky path at a certain age to get. Employers are starting to pay more attention, as we talked about the demographic changes. You know what? Going forward, they're going to have to. But right now, they're still dancing around it a bit.
Let's go back to our callers now. Julie is with us in Madison. Julie, hi.
Hi. Great show. I just wanted to say that I'm about 6 weeks into my retirement. I retired early at the age of 60, mostly because, I just wanted to work less or, you know, not at all. I have friends that are retired. And as I was telling the screener, I worked for the state, so I have feel fortunate to have a pretty good pension plan. And also with the way the state does your, you know, health coverage when you retire, if you have money if you have sick time, you know, they convert it to a pool of money to help pay for your health insurance. So I'll be able to use that till I reach Medicare age.
And Julie, before I let you go, do you think someday you might do some part-time work, say? I know you're just six weeks in now.
Yes, I think so. I'm a nurse. I'm a registered nurse, so I feel the opportunities might be pretty good. But I might decide to do, you know, something completely out of that realm as well.
I think there might be demand for a registered nurse out there. I don't know. Julie, good luck in retirement, however you decide to approach that. It seems like Carrie, she thought it through pretty well, though.
I absolutely love what Julie just told us, because that's it. You know, really taking a look at what you've got and what your options are. And she's right. You look around and you say, you know, this is one life I have, and there are lots of things I want to be able to enjoy. We don't know how long we have when we start seeing people around us retiring, and you start thinking, well, hey, maybe I need to just do some things right now for myself, and then I'll step back in. And people like to contribute and have an impact on the world still, but you might just, you know, take that pause. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just you need to make sure that you are employable when you get to that next stage. And what you mentioned too about pivoting to maybe something completely different, I love that idea, because that gets you so excited about work again, because it's something new and your learning curve ramps up. So that's a lot of fun if you have that opportunity.
Thanks again for that call. Carrie, I want to talk about the concept of a new chapter and changing jobs. I've talked to people who are getting up there in years who are, you know, roofers or contractors who are like, yeah, I like my work. I'm getting to an age where I don't necessarily want to be up on a ladder or can carry heavy stuff all the time. Thoughts on how people doing that kind of work can segue into something, stay in the workforce, even if it's not exactly what they're doing now?
Yeah, those are tougher pivots. But what you need to do is really stay connected to a network of people you know. And often you hear of opportunities or things that interest you through those networks. They're informal. It's not like you're asking other people, you know, to find a job for you. You're just kind of exploring. And I like to call it sort of the MRI, the inner MRI about what is it that I'd like to do? Use this. And I say in my book, In Control at 50 Plus, like, take control. This is your time. What is it that you would like to do? And what skills do you need? Maybe you already have those, even in those contracting jobs, you know, all those roofing jobs. There's things that you do that are transferable to other kinds of work that isn't so physically intensive. And it's something that you need to kind of work through, or things that you may love to do. Maybe you have great communication skills or things like that, which are super important, or you're willing to spend some time learning some of the digital stuff that's out there. And there's, you don't have to go back to school to learn this stuff. There's so much education available online today.
And Carrie, in just our last minute or so, we started off with this one data point from the Federal Reserve and this jump in retirement. What for you is the big open question on retirement in America?
Yeah, the sustainability of people who can afford to live 30 years without a paycheck. Beyond Social Security, if they haven't saved appropriately, and most people have not. And it's just, it's not a tenable situation for many people. So we need to find ways to extend working lives in a positive way. Not that it's drudgery and torture, but we need, you know, workplace training at the job centers are all around the country. The U.S. government, Department of Labor has, and we need to have a focus on older workers and find ways to help them redo their resumes. It's quite different. And career coaching at these centers are really geared to someone younger. Let's ramp them up and help people at a different age group recalibrate and focus on the kind of jobs they can do, what they can add to the workplace. Because you know what? The workplace demand, we need older workers to stay for the economy to stay strong, because not only are they paying themselves, they're also consumers. They're buying things out in the community. So this is a big question that I think that our whole society has to navigate.
Carrie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Carrie Hannon, senior columnist for Yahoo Finance. She's a workplace futurist and strategist on career transitions, entrepreneurship, personal finance, and retirement, author of a number of books, including In Control at 50 Plus. She joined us to talk about the most recent retirement wave hitting the U.S., how it can inform our own retirement plans. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Wisconsin State Assembly passed a series of bills last week related to truancy and chronic absenteeism for students. The bills included changes to the definition of truancy, how it's reported, and programs to try and prevent it. One bill would hold students back a grade if they have more than 30 school days of unexcused absences. The legislation came from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss's task force on truancy. Republican State Representative Amy Binsfeld of Sheboygan chaired that committee and said it's important to have repercussions for students who aren't showing up to school.
To insinuate that this bill just means I'm going to miss 30 days and woe is me, I'm out. Well, if you're missing that in October, we have bigger problems. And to act as though the research shows retaining a student is detrimental, well, I don't know how a student not being in school is beneficial. How are we raising people in society to say, miss 1/6 of your year at work and let me promote you?
Opponents of the bill, like Democratic State Representative Christina Shelton of Green Bay, say that punishing students for truancy won't make it easier for them to get to school.
There is absolutely no evidence at all or research to support that holding kids back will somehow incentivize them and help their family overcome barriers to getting them to school.
The bills passed the Assembly, would still need to make it through the state Senate before going to the governor's desk. Governor Evers hasn't commented on this legislation specifically. The State Department of Public Instruction has come out against it. Our next guest has researched the causes of chronic absenteeism among students and how it affects their education. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the state should deal with truancy? Do you support this idea where if you miss X amount of school with unexcused absences, you should repeat that grade? if you are involved in schools, working at schools, a teacher, a student, parent, what are you seeing when it comes to not seeing students at school? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Winchell-Lenhoff is an associate professor of educational leadership and policy studies and the Leonard Kaplan Endowed Professor in the College of Education at Wayne State University in Detroit. She's director of the Detroit Partnership for Education Equity and Research. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Before we start digging into possible solutions, it seems like one thing I think people agree on is students don't learn as well when they're not in school. Absenteeism is a problem when it comes to kids' educational outcomes, right?
That's absolutely right. I mean, the research is really clear. The more days students miss, the worse their outcomes. Their achievement outcomes, they're less likely to graduate, more likely to drop out the more days of school they miss.
And my understanding is during COVID, and then once people started going back to school, absenteeism got worse. What kind of things are we seeing?
Yeah, so in 2018-19, across the country, chronic absence was about 15%. In the 2021 school year, it rose to about 28%. So a huge jump, almost double nationwide. A lot of that had to do with the shift to online learning. Many students had trouble with, computer technology, the internet, parents had challenges kind of dealing with homeschooling and work and things like that. So we saw this huge uptick during COVID. And even in the years since then, when kids have been back to school in person for the most part, we've seen chronic absence at higher levels than pre-pandemic in most places across the country.
Now, a lot of your research has focused on why. Why does a particular kid not show up at school? As you dig into this, and you've done a lot of work in Detroit in particular, what do you see as the causes?
So us researchers like to say things are complicated, and this is no exception, right? What we found in Detroit, and I've been studying chronic absence in partnership with public schools here in Detroit since 2016, before the pandemic, is that students miss school for all sorts of reasons, and students who are chronically absent tend to have overlapping reasons, many times related to either health issues that aren't being addressed or are poorly addressed, or issues related to poverty and not having enough resources to get to school. So things like unreliable transportation, conflicts with their parents' work schedule and school schedule, where they can't figure out how to get their child to school because of that, childcare concerns. And for many students, these things overlap, right? They miss one day, maybe because their car breaks down. They miss another day because they're sick. They miss another day because their parent has a work conflict. And then these days pile up and they get to that point of chronic absence, which is about 10% of school days in the year.
And then here came COVID and made everything even more complicated. And one notion I've seen out there, Sarah, is, okay, if I'm a student and I can't get online to do my classes and I slip behind there a little more, now it's return to school and I'm even further behind and maybe I've gotten a habit of not connecting to school. Is that part of the story of why we're not seeing kids bounce back and show up at school more?
Yeah, I think we're still learning exactly why we're still seeing high rates of absence kind of post-pandemic, but I think that's a really plausible reason. We know from research prior to the pandemic that students who were further behind in school had worse attendance. And, we theorize that that's because school's harder if you're behind, right? You might be lost, you might be struggling, it's more difficult, and maybe it makes you not want to go to school. The other thing we know is that the more students miss school, the more likely it is that their peers will miss school, and that will kind of have a cascading effect on the classroom. And we think that's largely because teachers are then trying to catch up students who are at different levels, who may have had a lesson one day and missed another day, and it becomes a really difficult environment for the teacher to manage.
Talking to Sarah Winchell-Lenhoff, education professor at Wayne State University, looking at chronic absenteeism among students, truancy, the state legislature working on some bills aimed at tackling that issue, including saying, hey, if you miss X amount of school, 30 unexcused absences in a year, you might be held back a year. Love to hear your thoughts, maybe your experiences in schools yourself at 800-642-1234 or your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, in some of your work, you've talked about the idea of what you call an ecological approach to absenteeism. What does that mean?
Well, for us, that means that it's complicated, and it also means that schools should not be the only institution at the table when talking about how to improve student attendance. What we've seen in Detroit is that many of the reasons students miss high levels of school aren't really in the control of a school. You know, a school has a hard time kind of managing problems with parent work schedules, or, you know, a lack of a car, or childcare issues. And so some of these things are really, you know, government problems, social welfare agency issues that really need to be managed from a kind of societal level. You know, schools can do a lot, right? And we ask them to do a lot, but they can't solve every social problem. And what we've found is that many of these kind of these problems that arise from social inequality are at the root of chronic absence, and schools can only do so much within their scope of influence.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi. You know, I know a number of parents who were very upset when the school shut down for COVID against the parents' wishes. And then when the schools opened up again, and then their child was a little bit sick, they would hold them back, and the school would say, hey, how important it is to send your kids to school. And so many parents were just so upset at the school that they shut down inappropriately, and there was a little hangover effect where people are going to say, you know, how important is it? And they didn't have the kids go to school. I know a lot of parents that did that for a period of time. Do you think that hangover effect is still out there?
Steve, thanks for the call. What do you think, Sarah?
It's a really good question. I've actually heard that theory quite a bit. I don't know that we have any kind of hard evidence on how much that's happening. I do know that there's some mixed messages out there, certainly since the pandemic, about the importance of getting to school, who gets to decide when your child, you know, is sick enough to stay home or not, or, you know, should stay home for other reasons. So I do think kind of consistency in messaging, trying to repair that relationship between schools and families is really important here. We know from prior research that having that strong, you know, school-family bond is really essential for all kinds of things for kids, but especially for attendance, right? Families aren't going to tell a school what their issues are in getting their child to school if there's not a positive relationship already there as a foundation. So I do think schools have work to do in building those relationships, potentially repairing those relationships if they were broken during the pandemic.
Thanks for the call, Steve. We're talking to Wayne State University educational policy researcher Sarah Lenhoff about truancy and chronic absenteeism among students. The Wisconsin legislature considering a bill that would hold students back for having 30 days of unexcused absences in a year. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions for our guest. Thoughts on how to deal with chronic absenteeism among many students and maybe your own experiences as a student, parent, teacher. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Sarah Lenhoff, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at Wayne State University, looking at a jump starting in the COVID era, continuing to today, in truancy and chronic absenteeism among students. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now with Torsten in Waukesha County. Torsten, hi.
Oh, hi. So I just wanted to give my own personal insight. I'm currently a senior who's struggling with chronic absenteeism related to mental health problems. And I wanted to know how our guest here could think that they could help support people with mental health problems in getting into school and make sure that they are not held back unjustly, and how we can make sure that they are not persecuted for it.
Torsten, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Torsten, I think not alone, certainly. We're seeing a lot of concern about teens and mental health. Your thoughts for Torsten, Sarah?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thanks for calling in, and good luck in your senior year, Torsten. You know, mental health issues among young people have really risen in this COVID and post-COVID era as well. And so you're not alone in your struggles. I would say that, you know, schools need to have that kind of supportive approach rather than punitive. We know that young people who are struggling need connection to people who to support them, to resources. One thought is in Michigan, where I live, lawmakers have introduced a bill to make mental health days excused absences in Michigan that wouldn't count against them for truancy purposes. So that's one possibility, but that alone isn't going to solve the issue. So I would say, you know, we need to do a lot more on the preventative side to make sure kids aren't missing school, but we also need to do more on that. What do we do when kids do miss school, right? Students are going to miss school. We're never going to, you know, have 100% attendance rate, and we wouldn't want that. We don't want kids coming to school really sick, for instance. So how do we make sure that kids who are missing school for whatever reason are able to catch up, whether that's, you know, putting more resources into intervention, into tutoring, into extra support during the school day or afterward, or even, you know, using some of that technology that we learned how to build during the pandemic to help them do some of their coursework online or in another way.
Thanks again for that call, Torsten. Before we go back to our callers, Sarah, I wanted to ask about the idea of, as is in this one state bill, of saying, hey, if you have X amount and 30 or so unexcused absences, you have to repeat a grade. That the idea of repeating a grade based on chronic absenteeism, what do you think of that as a solution?
Well, I worry a lot about that as a solution, because I think that what we've shown in our research, what others have shown, is that students, by and large, you know, is there, of course, always exceptions, but most students who are chronically absent are not missing a ton of school because they just don't care, right? It's not a matter of motivation for the students or families for the most part. And so, you know, kind of putting in a punitive approach where you're saying we're going to hold you accountable, we're going to punish you if you don't show up, really suggests that you think that motivation is the main cause and that it will be solved through this punitive measure. What I worry about is that the underlying root cause of the absences still won't be resolved. The student will have the negative effects of being retained, which are social and academic. There's very, you know, there's minimal evidence that retention is a positive thing for most children. So I would really worry about many students being more harmed through this bill than helped.
Let's go back to our callers now. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. My question is, how does this compare or contrast with the previous notion of no child left behind? Doesn't it seem to kind of conflict with that? And secondly, is there some place where we're not seeing where this is going to affect funding for schools?
Chris, thanks for the call. Sarah, first of all, No Child Left Behind, I can't remember how it dealt in particular or if it dealt directly with the issue of absenteeism. Any thoughts on how it might fit in?
Yeah, it's a good question. No Child Left Behind didn't really deal with attendance or absenteeism, but we had a revision to No Child Left Behind in the mid-2010s called the Every School Student Succeeds Act. And that federal law allowed states to include chronic absence in their school accountability systems. And about 37 states did just that. And so schools now are accountable for how many students are chronically absent or miss lots of school in their buildings. And, you know, I think it's a great thing that schools are paying attention to attendance. This isn't a really important issue. But again, it goes back to how much is really within the control of the school to solve. And if we're going to hold schools accountable, how are we providing them with resources to make sure that they're able to provide resources to families who need help getting to school?
And thanks for that call, Chris. And holding schools accountable, does that mean cutting funding if they hit certain levels of absenteeism? Is that how that's worked in practice?
It can, yeah. So I know in Michigan, for instance, in Texas, for instance, there, you know, if a school district's attendance drops below a certain rate for a day, then they get dinged on their school funding. There can also be repercussions in terms of their, you know, on their scorecard if they're getting a lower grade on the state accountability system, and that could affect their enrollment, right? If their score is lower, fewer parents might decide to enroll there. So it does have funding implications in many cases.
Thanks again for the call, Chris. Talking to Sarah Lenhoff from Wayne State University, looking at truancy, absenteeism. It's gone up for students in the post-COVID era. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Westby. Jim, hi.
Hey.
What'd you want to bring up, Jim?
I just have a comment or maybe a statement or a question. Why would kids be held back just for missing school? I mean, if they can pass and get a passing grade, shouldn't they still move on? Shouldn't it be based off of merit and not just off of attendance?
Jim, thanks for the call. Sarah, what do you think?
I think I agree with Jim. You know, I think there's really, you know, very little evidence that retention is an effective mechanism to improve students' academic careers. And when it is effective, it really requires a lot of academic intervention and different support in the school than they were receiving the year before, and should be done very mindfully. So I don't think a blanket retention policy just for attendance is very likely to help students and more likely to harm them.
Thanks again for that call. One thing I wanted to ask about that you mentioned earlier, Sarah, was the transportation issue. It sounds really basic, but I know some districts have shaken things up where, you know, the neighborhood school might not be a walkable school, or you're going to school on the other side of your community. Have we changed things in a way just geographically that can make it more of a challenge for kids to make it to school?
That's an awesome question. I've actually done a lot of research in this area. The short answer is no. We have a lot more school choice now. So you're right. Many students nationwide are going to school much further from home than they used to. But school bus offerings haven't kept up. So, you know, we have roughly 38% of students in the country are taking the bus to school, even though many more students are traveling further distances. And so we kind of have this gap where parents are being asked to make up the difference, right, with their personal car. But we know that many families don't have a personal car, share it with, you know, many people who need it for things like work and other appointments. And so, you know, especially for students living in high poverty areas, this is a really critical problem. I do a lot of work of my work in Detroit. A third of families don't own a car in Detroit, and 50% of students here don't have access to a school bus. So, you know, there's right there just a gap in how students are supposed to get to school that we really need to fill as a society, not only from the school side, but also the city and state.
Time for one more caller. Joe is with us in Black River Falls. Joe, hi.
Hi. So, I work in one of the local school districts, and one of the things that we always try to, like, are always kind of combating is this, you know, chronic absenteeism. And it's really kind of tricky because a lot of the reasons why, you know, some kids are just not in school is just from a lot of the kind of precipitating factors in the community. You know, like you kind of mentioned before, that whether they have access at home to come along to school, or even, you know, if there's things going on in the home that make it really difficult. And I think as districts kind of struggle because they can only go so far.
Interesting, Joe. Thanks for the call. And just our last minute, Sarah, what can districts do in that situation? They can't do it all, as you've said, but what options are there for them?
Yeah, great question, Joe. And thanks for your work as an educator. You know, I think school districts can partner with community-based organizations who are already working directly with families to provide social services and other support. They can advocate for their city and state governments to step up to the plate and make sure that families are supported in other ways. They can also do things like work with large employers in the area to make sure that work schedules are accommodating to drop kids off in the morning or pick them up after school when they need to. So I think there's a lot schools can do to kind of reach out beyond their doors to make this a community issue and not just a school issue.
Joe, thanks for the call. And Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Sarah Winchell-Lenhoff, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies and the Leonard Kaplan Endowed Professor in the College of Education at Wayne State University in Detroit. She's with us today for a look at the issues of truancy and chronic absenteeism among students as Wisconsin lawmakers consider a package of bills related to the issue. You can read more about that legislation in our reporting over at WPR.org. It's crunch time this week. Our winter member drive is on Wednesday, and this year it is just one day long. Just one day to raise the funds that typically take a whole week. But we're up for the challenge, and we know you are too. You can join in now with your gift to make it a success at WPR.org/donate. Here's a unique measure of inflation that's gone down a bit. How much money kids get for their lost teeth, like, you know, from the tooth fairy. As reported in Axios, Delta Dental surveys people on how much kids get for the lost baby tooth under the pillow. It went down a bit since last year, but the average nationwide is still $5.84. That's way off the charts for my kids were losing teeth. I think it was like a quarter or maybe a dollar at the most. That makes sense. According to the survey, the average was under $2 about 20 years ago. Kids in the Midwest today get a lower amount than the national average at $3.63. I don't know, man. It's just economics. If the tooth compensation rate gets too high, you're encouraging kids to collect extra teeth. You could end up like a criminal racket of six-year-olds smuggling contraband bicuspids. I don't want to live in that world. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we hear from the author of the new book, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about being seen.
What's one of the best ways to combat hate? For Jesus Gregorio Smith of Appleton, it's to push back with love. He shares his story as part of the Home is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Latino residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
I saw the sign up on Richmond Street in downtown Appleton, and I couldn't believe my eyes. It was just a sign flashing the F word, the one that rhymes with maggots. It was displayed across a business sign so everyone driving down the road could see it like it was nothing. All I could think about was how could this be possible? Those poor queer kids who already have a hard time with family, within themselves being gay or bi or trans, what happens when they see this sign spewing so much hate? I had to do something. I've experienced my fair share of hatred and bigotry throughout my life. I was born and raised in the little old town of El Paso, Texas. My father, Johnny Smith, is an African-American man who was born in the 1940s during legal segregation. While Dad was stationed at Fort Bliss, he traveled to Juarez, Mexico, with his fellow soldiers for drinks and fun nights. It's there he fell in love with my mother, Sonia Smith. Once they were married, they had 5 mixed-race children. I'm the youngest of the 5. I had the luxury and honor of having 2 cultural backgrounds and influences in my life. But that luxury also had costs. I recall the first time I was ever called the N-word, and it was by Mexican folks. And I thought to myself, don't we all have it bad enough? Why are we picking on each other? I'll never forget the time my mother gave me this serious talk in first grade because she was embarrassed with how feminine I was as a child. In fact, the first person to ever call me the F word was my mother. My father instilled a particular vision of Black masculinity that was meant to protect my brothers and I in the world. He stressed that I needed to get a good job in computers in order to be successful. As I got older, I hid my gayness and only pursued paths that would make my family proud, keep me hidden, and keep the comments about me to a minimum. But college didn't lead to a career in computers. Instead, I faced my fears and embraced my identity. I began empowering fellow members of the queer LGBTQIA community. Eventually, I got my PhD in sociology with a focus on race, sexuality, and masculinity. And that's what brought me to Wisconsin, a job at Appleton's Lawrence University as an assistant professor of ethnic studies. Which brings me back to that homophobic sign I saw in downtown Appleton. I didn't let the hate deter me. So when I decided to protest under the sign, I gated it up even more to be exactly what the sign said I was. I put on a purple wig, a rainbow shirt, white high heels, and danced around to Born This Way by Lady Gaga. I filmed a silly video and took a photo. The photo went viral on social media. Not too long after, numerous Appleton residents showed up to fight against the hate, resulting in it coming down. I took that viral image, put it on a shirt, and sold it, and raised $15,000 for the Sexual Assault Crisis Center. That is how you turn that hate into love. Through the process of finding oneself, embracing oneself, and living as one's authentic self, one can counter painful experiences and turn them into something different. I tried to hide myself from pain, but when I bravely faced it, I overcame it. It isn't easy, but I think we deserve to see a different world. Determining your own path, despite what others say, can help you break out of molds that confine you. I eventually embraced who I was and made a huge difference in people's lives, as well as my own.
Jesus Gregorio Smith is an associate professor of ethnic studies at Lawrence University. His story is part of the Home Is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made of six media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press Gazette. More information can be found at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Do you remember when you were a kid and maybe your best friend was the most important person in the world? Here's Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle in the show Pen 15 playing middle school versions of themselves, imagining what life would be like when they're grown up.
We share a dorm after school.
Yes.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I cook you all of your lunches.
Oh, yeah. And I cook breakfast, dinners, and snacks.
Because you're the only one who knows how I like my onions to be cooked.
I knew you were going to say onions
sautéed.
Yeah, and we're going to have a double wedding.
Yeah. And then we'll probably get divorced at the same time.
Because they got in the way of us.
Yeah. And then we'll probably have kids like a couple years apart so that you can help me raise mine because I'm going to have issues with it.
And we can live on the same property, right?
Yeah. And then when you get sick, I'm going to take you to the doctor every day because it's a block away, okay?
Why don't friends grow up and live together? Maybe have a family together or take care of each other when they get older? Why isn't friendship at the center of life? Well, sometimes it is. Our next guest writes about friends who have chosen to live their lives together in ways that break a lot of the unspoken rules about American friendship, and in a way that runs up against the assumption that a romantic relationship should be the center of our lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had or do you have a friendship like this that's as important to you, maybe more important than a romantic partnership? Have you felt a friendship get demoted when somebody has that romantic relationship? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Raina Cohen is producer and editor for the NPR podcast Embedded. She's the author of The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. Raina, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for being here. And I love that clip at the top.
It was good. Credit to the producer on that one. I didn't find it. Now, you've experienced friendships like this, and you kept finding people who had these intense friendships. And it seems like everybody felt kind of alone and odd ducks, but it's more common than we might think. Tell us of what you set off to find in this book.
I had a personal experience in a friendship like this that felt like best friend didn't even cut it as a label, where my friend and I were really enmeshed in each other's lives in a way that wasn't so different from the romantic partnership I've been in concurrently. And I wanted to find other people who had this kind of friendship because I knew that we were not the only ones, and that there was something fundamentally challenged by these friendships in terms of the hierarchies of relationships, in terms of the emotions and the kind of commitment we're told we're only supposed to experience in romantic relationships, or you can only form families through romantic relationships. And I found people who are of all different ages and political persuasions and genders who have exactly this kind of friendship. And one of the remarkable things of those stories and what I've heard since the book has come out is everybody feels like they're isolated and nobody gets these friendships, and yet so many people have them.
And before we meet some of the people you profile in the book, a common theme, again, is that they have a hard time explaining it. We don't necessarily have the language for it. If we look to pop culture, the happy ending is always that romantic relationship. How did we downgrade this possibility of this intimate, passionate, productive friendship in favor of romantic relationships to such a huge degree?
It certainly was not always this way, that a romantic partner was supposed to be the be-all and end-all and be your everything. You know, just in the last 50 years, we've gone from thinking you were supposed to have love be the core part of your relationship and maybe companionship, to also reaching the highest heights of yourself and having a person help you, you know, figure out the best version of yourself and be your best friend, which doesn't obviously leave very much room for a best friend if your romantic partner is taking that role. But it, you know, if you look back even further, a couple hundred years ago, and we can go way back, the expectation was that a spouse was really providing a kind of practical role, that marriage would be merging families, would be more like an economic contract that was about the resources that two people and their families can exchange. So a lot of people found the most emotional intimacy in their friendships, which makes a lot of sense when, you know, the marriage wasn't expected to fill that role. And also there was such an inequality between men and women that it's kind of hard to have an egalitarian relationship like friendship, or an egalitarian relationship in a marriage, really, if you're not equals to one another. But you can find that equality more in friendship.
I want to meet a couple of the people you talk to. Andrew and his friend, Tolly, a couple of guys, they end up describing each other, I think, as a platonic life partners. Can you tell us a little bit about their story?
Yeah, they were a couple of the first people I talked to. They are now in their 30s, and they met when they were in high school and just became part of a friend group eventually. There were three of them who were really close, Andrew, Tolly, and their friend David. And as they went off to college, David ended up dying by suicide. And Andrew and Tolly were really there for each other during this massive period of grief, and also trying to help David through all of his mental health challenges up until then. And that, you know, was one thing that kind of cemented the friendship. But they have gone on to make major life decisions around one another. They have moved across, one has moved across the country for the other. They've oriented their careers so that they can be living and working in close proximity. They created a nonprofit together. And they've also run into issues with romantic partners because people don't understand how a friendship could be as significant as it is, and that the women that they've dated often hit a point where they don't feel comfortable not being absolutely the number one person in their life. So they, you know, at a time in their lives, in their, you know, 20s and 30s, when everyone around them was saying you should kind of build your life around a romantic relationship, they decided to do something different, and often kind of ended up really confusing people and getting judgment from people, and people wondering if was it actually a sexual relationship. They just couldn't compute that it was a friendship.
Raina Cohen is with us, author of the new book, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have that kind of special long-term friendship with someone that equals or exceeds maybe a romantic partnership in your life? Do you have questions for our guest about some of the things she found? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Raina Cohen about her new book, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What role have friends played in your life? Do you have that friend who's before all others, maybe more important relationship than a spouse or significant other? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Nick is with us in Beloit. Nick, hi.
Hey, I had a bit of a question about this. So I know a lot of people spend time at work, and in the recent years, people have been talking a lot about the idea of a work wife or work husband. Is this kind of the same thing, or is it just a shade of what you're discussing here?
Nick, thanks for the call. I think people may mean a different levels, Rada, of a commitment when it comes to that work wife or work husband, but that idea of someone else in life providing emotional connection in addition to what someone might get in, say, a marriage or other significant relationship. I don't know. It seems like it parallels at least some of what you write about.
And there's definitely overlap. I think one example of somebody who would have been maybe like work husbands to each other are actually Andrew and Tolly, who I described mm-hmm. in many ways are like work husbands to one another. They worked in the same physics lab for a while. They are doing the same, working in the same place right now. They started a nonprofit, as I mentioned. So, I think what takes this to a slightly different level might be that it's not just in a workplace setting that these people have these really close bonds, but that they're also, making decisions to live with or near each other, to maybe raise kids together, to look toward a shared future is really the way that I would define the sorts of friendships or platonic partnerships, as I call them in the book. But I think anybody who's experienced a platonic relationship of real intensity can relate to the way that these friends connect with one another.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Another pair that you write about, Barb and Inez. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that name wrong.
Yeah.
Inez, yeah. They end up later in life moving in together. Can you tell us a little bit about their story?
Yeah, I love the two of them. So I met them in the house that they share in the suburbs of St. Louis. And they've been best friends for 50 years, and they supported each other in all sorts of ways, including when Inez got divorced from her husband, and she has two children, and Barb is very involved in taking care of the kids. And when the two of them were on the cusp of retirement, Barb wanted to move back to St. Louis from where they'd been living in Arizona. And Inez decided to follow, and they wanted to buy their own homes that were maybe next door or really close proximity, but they couldn't afford it. And what they eventually decided to do was to buy a home together. And now they are roommates or housemates, and they have been for 25 years. And it has been a great source of companionship and comfort and care. They, do their grocery shopping together. They go to the same primary care doctor. They do a lot of volunteering together. They're really inseparable in a lot of ways, though they have a wider community around them.
A theme that comes up a lot is, some people that you write about, they are the main relationship in each other's lives. But in many cases, there might be a romantic partner, significant other, whatever, and this long-term friendship. And it seems like almost a cliche, all right? Well, yes, you've got this close friend, but now you're getting married or committed in some way. So it's time to downgrade that friendship. It's not as big a deal anymore. How have people worked around that? How have people solved it so they can have both of those great relationships?
Lots of people run into problems with some partners, romantic partners who don't feel comfortable with the friendship, are suspicious of it, or just want more space in their romantic partner's life. But for the ones where it does work, there's usually some understanding on the side of the romantic partner that there's a benefit to be had, that not relying on your romantic partner for everything actually can make the relationship stronger. And what I found in the cases of Andrew and in another story that I tell, both of them had issues previously with, other partners getting them on board, but then they found somebody who themselves had really close friendships or a sense of chosen family. And they, had experienced for themselves how nourishing a friendship can be, and that they also did not want to cut off ties to their friends or downgrade their friends in order to be part of the romantic relationship. So it was sort of finding somebody who had some awareness of how deep the friendship can be and how there could be this sort of multiplier effect where the friendships enrich the romantic relationships and vice versa.
Talking to Raina Cohen, author of the new book, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. Back to your calls with Cortland in Madison. Cortland, hi. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I just had been listening to your program here and listened to a few of the situations. And I thought, you know, I've got a friend of mine that, shucks, we've been friends for 25 years. And we're friends before both of us were married. We're both heterosexual. We both love our wives and we love our families. And yet I imagine if we would talk about it, you know, I think that we're probably, our friendship together is closer than my friendship to my wife and his friendship to his wife. I mean, like I say, we love our wives and we love our children, but, it's just maybe a little bit different than what you've spoken about. But I can understand how these people have relationships that, their friendships are closer than their romantic relationships.
Cortland, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And Raina, I think a lot of guys, straight guys, wouldn't necessarily express this in that way, that this is a closer relationship in some ways even than their spouses. Your thoughts on Cortland's story?
Yeah, I mean, I love hearing it. And if you're looking at the stats on this, yes, it is much more rare for men to say that they feel more emotional intimacy with their male friends than they do with their female spouses. And the reverse is true for heterosexual women. In terms of, if you've heard the term, the friendship recession, that there is a decline in the number of friends and close friends Americans have, men are really faring a lot worse on this measure. But, that's not the case for every single person. What I found interesting and what Cortland was saying is that there is a need to almost justify or really make clear, like, I love my wife, but I also love my friend, and that there's some way at this point that it's almost like an affront to say that you care for a friend or feel as closer to a friend than you do a spouse. But a lot of people feel that way, and it also, you don't have to be best friends with your spouse. You can have a best friend, or you can have many close friends, and again, these things can enrich each other and not detract.
Thanks for that call, Raina. Just in our last less than a minute, what would you say to someone who feels what you're talking about and doesn't know how to tell other people in their life, doesn't know how to put it into words?
You know, I think it helps to look at models that are out there, which could be the nonfiction models and like the ones that I'm describing, or looking out into pop culture at, the men who, the protagonists in Scrubs, the women in Broad City, those TV shows, and say, if you've seen that and you understand that, that's the kind of friendship that I have.
Raina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on and for the callers, too.
That's Raina Cohen, producer and editor for the NPR podcast Embedded. She talked to us today about her new book. It's called The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. Hey, still time for you to share your story. If you have one that fits the theme, you can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's time for a clear constitutional right to vote in the United States. That's according to an elections expert who makes the case that a constitutional amendment can answer a lot of our current arguments about voting rights and how we handle our elections in the country. Also tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing a challenge to EPA air quality enforcement rules that aim to protect states from pollution that comes from other states. We'll find out what could be at stake in that decision. And as always, you can weigh in with your questions and your opinions. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.